folks, it's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. We'll be just talking with Michael Austin, who's one of our favorite people. If you want to have a serious discussion, he's a good author to do it with. We've had him on, I think, three times before, maybe just two. And we've discussed everything from the Second Amendment to the Book of Job. He's a provost at the University of Evansville, Indiana, he's written a whole bunch of books on a lot of his work. A lot of your work, Michael, is literary criticism and textbooks and things like that.
Yes, that's my profession. I was, before I was an academic administrator, I was a professor of English. And so I have written a number of books looking at literature, and then a textbook that is used in freshman composition courses.
And you come from the Mormon tradition and have written about Mormon scriptures and stuff for a larger audience. Is that right?
Yes. Especially the Book of Job, and but also the Book of Mormon I've written about. So I do keep a hand in that. Fortunately, I'm in an administrative position now where I can write about anything I want to write about.
Right.
Rather than having to write about a certain type of British literature, which is what I had to do when I was a professor.
Right. So you're a provost now, which I don't know exactly what it is.
Provost is another name for the vice president for academic affairs at a university, and basically it's the second in command.
Yeah, and when I was in school,
there's a president, and then there's a provost.
Yeah, and when I was in school, it was vice president for. Your new book is "We Must Not Be Enemies."
Yes,
and it's taken from Lincoln's first inaugural address.
Correct.
And at that time, you told me right before the show, seven states had already withdrawn from the Union, and he has as the theme, we must not be enemies. Even the fact that because he's gotten elected, they're leaving the Union.
And Lincoln was trying to prevent a civil war, or he was trying to keep as many states in the Union as possible. And I think something people sometimes forget or sometimes miss that Lincoln actually was somewhat successful at doing that. There, seven states seceded before he was inaugurated, just because he was elected. Four more states would secede for a total of 11, but four slave states remained in the Union. So Kentucky, Missouri, Maryland, and Delaware remained in the Union, and then West Virginia split off of the Union. So at the time of this speech, Lincoln knew there were border states that he was appealing to try to keep in the Union, and he did that much more successfully than people remember.
Yeah, they think of it as a sort of a one-note thing. Lincoln's elected, and the country splits in two with the Confederacy on one side and a Union on the other. You say in your book that your book, which is about what you call civic friendship, you want to define that term. It's from Aristotle, you say?
So civic friendship is a term from Aristotle, from his Ethics. And for him, this is the thing that makes any form of government work. You know, Aristotle said that there are democracies, there are oligarchies, there are monarchies. They can all work if people in the country have this relationship, this civic friendship with each other, and they will all become very bad forms of government if they don't. So civic friendship is the feeling that you have for people that you share a country with, that you wish them well rather than wish them ill, that you, all other things equal, you want them to succeed, you want them to be happy. And because, you know, we can't be friends with 300 million people, civic friendship is enacted through the kinds of policies that we advocate for and that we enact. And as Aristotle frames it, for a democracy to work, for a democracy to really become what he would call a constitutional republic, people have to be willing to enact policies and laws that don't simply grab every bit of power that's available for their side. You have to realize that other people have different perspectives than you do, and you've got to structure the country in a way that their happiness matters too.
And that's what we're seeing breaking. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So otherwise, you end up in a civil war.
And what we see now, I think that certainly in my lifetime, which is getting to be fairly long at this point of view, is that we're in the most deeply polarized situation that I've seen, political situation I've seen, with the angriest particularly on one side of the issue, just fury and both sides seem to be driven by antagonism for the other side as much as by their values.
Yes, 2016 was the first election on record since we started keeping records in which more people from both parties, more people said in the exit polls that they were voting against the other candidate than for their candidate. So we've hit a point of negative partisanship where right now who you're against matters more than who you're for. And people are voting against things rather than for things. And that's actually a pretty big tipping point.
When you one of the things you say in the book was, and I think when people see a title like "We Must Not Be Enemies" and it's about civic friendship, they tend to think that this is about a call to be polite to each other. And you say in your book, it's not a call for politeness. It's not arguing about the change, need to change the structure of the government. I know that most Democrats, we feel that the government has gotten more and more unrepresentative of us. So we win by a huge number of votes, and yet we have less representation than Republicans do. So that's an issue for Democrats, I think, not more than Republicans. And it does not describe, it's not a call to denounce one side or the other. So your book is about something a little different than I think people would see if they just look at the title. They think they'll look at it and think this is another call for if we're polite together, we speak well with each other, things will get better. And it does help. I had a debate with a extremely conservative gentleman, very much a gentleman, and about the Constitution. And his politeness, his good manners in the debate really did touch me. I mean, we became sort of friendly adversaries, at least in a small way, because politeness did work. You know, it did help a discussion about the Constitution where we really fundamentally disagreed about what should it be about. So I think we have to talk a little bit about civic friendship, Michael. I think it's a concept that people don't really have. There's a difference between being polite, having good manners, being respectful of other people, and civic friendship. Because civic friendship is not friendship in that we're pals, right? It's friendship in the sense of how we govern the country.
Yeah, the core idea of civic friendship is that we govern in a way that has room for people who don't agree with us. We don't try to shut them out. We don't try to shut them down. We don't try to decrease their ability to participate in the democratic process. The idea behind civic friendship, and really the main idea of the book, is that we have to argue with each other more. And we have to do it in certain ways that are actually arguments rather than shouting matches. Politeness, I think politeness is a good idea, and I think we should be respectful of other people and their opinions. But calls for politeness, I think, are misguided, because very often the key to politeness is you don't discuss certain things. It's much easier to be polite when you're not discussing the things that matter the most. So human beings are or are not polite to each other, and I think we should be whenever possible, but I don't think that we should encourage the kind of civility that says let's just not talk about these things, because we have to talk about these things. And it's easy to preserve a veneer of civility if you just never have important discussions, if you declare certain topics off limits, if you say we're just not going to talk about that. That's too high a cost to pay for politeness, because those issues are the issues that people in a democracy have to be able to talk about if they're going to govern themselves.
And de Tocqueville, when he wrote Democracy in America, 1831, I think, mm-hmm. one of his points, or one of his experiences in traveling around America and pretending to examine American prisons and penitentiaries and all of that, when he was actually just looking at what was going on in America, because I guess you'd call civic engagement had ended up very, very badly in France over and over again, one regime after another, mostly done violently. And he came to America, and one of his big observations was how much Americans argued with each other about everything all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Tocqueville really was consumed by the question of why democracy didn't work in France. France, like America, France had a revolution. They declared the principles of democracy. They were going to be a democratic society, and they ended up having just one form of tyranny after another. They had mob rule. They had Napoleon. They had another revolution and reinstalled the monarchy. Then they had another revolution and reinstalled a different monarchy. And the only way in Tocqueville society to make change was through violence, because democracy didn't work. And so what was it that made it work in America? And what he determined was that Americans do democracy every day. And just for an example of this, if you're with a group of friends, you know, there's five or six of you, and you want to watch a movie, how do you go about that?
Well, yes, exactly. I mean, we engage with each other. And I think what I've seen, you know, when I was young and in college, Young Americans for Freedom, very right-wing Republican organization, the guys lived right across from us in this big rooming house. And we used to engage in actual discussions. And discussions between people with different points of view, arguments between people with different points of view, seem to have completely disintegrated. And what we get on the internet anyway is these violent, crazy denunciation. And I know that most liberals don't do that, but what they do is select all the craziness on the right wing. In other words, they look at all the crazy things that the right wing has done, and they have it builds up their dislike and hatred of the right wing. When I was working with a lot of conservatives, they had the issue of guns. And if you're on one side, you had liberals looking at all the times that somebody has a gun and shoots his son-in-law or his daughter climbing into the house. And on the conservative side, you had the number of times that somebody's used a gun to actually protect themselves, seriously protected themselves. Some little old lady shoots a burglar. What I noticed was that both these events, two sides were selecting completely different events and not looking at the others. And also that these events were actually tiny a number, minuscule in it actually happening. So that the debate is huge, but the actual events that they're using to justify the positions are, you know, 10 a year or something.
Yeah, guns is one issue. You know, most of the issues we've sort of devolved into two very hardened positions: abortion, immigration, taxation, guns. We've devolved into these two standard positions, and we talk to each other a lot. Social media has amplified our ability to spend most of our time talking to people we agree with. And that has not been a good thing. Even more than that, it's made it possible for us to filter and curate news feeds that almost always end up confirming the point of view that we already have. So that if you're a very liberal person and you're on social media with other very liberal people and you're forwarding news stories from liberal sources, you're having conversations with liberal friends, you almost never encounter a realistic portrayal of the conservative position, and vice versa. If you're in conservative news sites and you're forwarding conservative news stories, you almost never encounter a liberal position unless it's filtered through and colored by the sources that you're reading and the people that you're having conversations with. So then on those few occasions where liberals and conservatives do meet, all they do is yell at each other. They shout at each other because their positions are so obvious and inevitable to them because the social media filtering devices have filtered out all of the other points of view. And that's really what social media is. It's just one big filter. We determine sometimes by choices we make actively and sometimes just by paths of choices, who we talk to, what things we like, we determine what we see. And so both sides in very real ways are living in filter bubbles where the other perspective is almost always presented as a caricature and not as something that a reasonable person could believe in.
The problem is we won't listen to somebody who's just yelling at us. The minute somebody starts yelling at us, we stop. I have a friend who went to a reunion in a small town in Oklahoma where I'm from. He signed up with all these people on Facebook, and their politics was so extreme in his view, he had to unfriend them all, some of them quietly and some of them directly. But that's because they weren't trying to discuss things with him, and they weren't arguing things. They were yelling at him about positions that he just didn't want to be inundated with that kind of yelling. And I think that works on both sides. I did kind of want to go back to de Tocqueville and his discussion of American mores. So this, I think, is one of the most important things that Americans don't understand. They see the Constitution, but they don't see the mores that underlie and make the Constitution work. All these 250 years of unwritten rules about what you do. And what de Tocqueville saw was that their mores, and he listed out, if my notes are correct, the right to disagree. In other words, we accept the fact that somebody has a right to disagree with this, that we think that persuasion is possible, and we accept the results of elections. And we can see that he wrote this in 2019, so we're in a situation where we accept the results of elections, exactly what we see not happening. So what's your take on these? What's the importance of them, and how do they function to make a democracy work? And it's worked here for 250 years, except for the Civil War, right? That was unresolvable by argument and discussion.
So the more one interesting phrase that Tocqueville uses to describe mores is habits of the heart. But these are not written into the Constitution. Let me just give you an example of a more that most people don't understand. And that is that there's no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. The Constitution never says people have a right to vote. That is a more. We believe that every vote should be counted, that everybody should have a right to vote. There are four negative rights articulated in the amendments that say if a state gives somebody the right to vote, they can't discriminate based on race, based on gender, based on age if they're over 18, or based on failure to pay a poll tax. But states don't have to let anybody vote. As far as the Constitution is concerned, the state of Pennsylvania could choose all 20 of its electors through a tiddlywinks tournament. Mm-hmm. There's nothing that says that you have to be able to vote. That's a more. We believe we have an expectation that voting is sacred and that everybody should have a right to vote and everybody's vote should be counted. And a lot of state constitutions do guarantee that. But that is not part of our Constitution. Another more that is being talked about a lot right now is the formal concession. I've seen a lot of people equate Donald Trump not giving a formal concession speech with refusing to leave office. And that's not the way that it works. There's no constitutional requirement for a concession speech. There's no constitutional requirement that the person who loses be gracious and give a speech and support the person coming in. Every president has done that since John Adams left office in 1801, went back to Massachusetts and let Jefferson take over. Every president has conceded and left office willingly, but that's not a requirement. The requirement is after January 20th, the current administration is not the president anymore. And that happens automatically. But even that is by law and not by Constitution. You know, the Constitution is a very, very small document. You can read it in just a few minutes. It doesn't say everything that needs to be said. It relies on the fact that people have some amount of goodwill towards each other and some willingness for the whole democratic project to continue. Because that's really what's at stake. Democracy can always, no matter how many guardrails you put in place, democracy can always descend into a tyranny of the majority. The majority can always change the Constitution, they can change the laws, they can change the structures. A majority that exists for long enough can structure the game in its favor so that the other side never has a chance of winning. When that happens, though, people stop being willing to participate in democracy. And that's when you get civil wars. That's when you get changed by violence, when there's no point to democracy anymore. So for 250 years, Americans from widely different political perspectives and positions have all had this sort of tacit, unspoken agreement that we want democracy to continue and we don't want to do anything so radical that it makes the whole democracy stop working. And I think we're starting to see examples of people no longer being willing to exercise that forbearance and to do things for the sake of short-term victories that damage the whole system such that it might not be able to continue. And that is a very, very precarious proposition, because without democracy, Tocqueville is absolutely right. If we don't respect the norms and mores and institutions of democracy, then the only way to change government is to throw up barricades in the street and start shooting.
Right. So if, for example, what we've seen in the last 4 years is a violation of all the mores, not only of government, but of common practice. I was at a meeting with a Franciscan priest, Father Richard Rohr, before the election, and he said about Trump, he said, the man ridiculed a person for his disabilities in public. And Richard Rohr said, what more do you need to know? Obviously, a lot of Americans needed to know a lot more, and maybe some of them have never gotten the point. What it does is raise the question of what's important. We have someone stomping all this. The court cases, look, folks, the court cases, everybody goes, oh, that's just not the law. This won't happen. They can't overturn millions of votes in Michigan and Pennsylvania and stuff based on some speculation. It's not legal. It's not going to happen. But I think that they're not seeing the willingness of people to bring that kind of suit under the complaint that there's some kind of mischief in the voting, the absolute breaking of the American mores. If the courts, for example, did say, okay, well, we're going to invalidate 240,000 votes in Pennsylvania, and then where would the country be? What do you think?
Then very quickly, the judges would determine elections, and democracy would be pointless. And I think that the courts understand that. The courts, the federal judiciary, has, I think, been the only branch of government that understands this right now. That once courts get in the business of overturning elections, that there's no point to democracy. All that matters is your ability to control who sits on the courts. And that's a very, very dangerous position to be in, because that's a position that could end up with one side permanently establishing itself, and then the other side doesn't have an incentive to play the game anymore. And the only place that that ends is civil war.
Yes, and we see countries now, and what's the term? They're illiberal democracies like Hungary, where we have a strong man who has redone the judiciary so that it favors his political party. He's redone the districts in which people vote. He's done this so that he's tried to, and apparently successfully, establish it's still a democracy. People still vote, but everything is biased in his favor of his political party. And I think there's a growing number of these, and they use Poland as an example. But countries that even with strong men have elections.
Everybody has elections. The veneer of democracy is very important. I think that, except for a couple of countries that are still monarchies, everybody says that they have elections, but those elections don't always determine how government works. And yeah, Fareed Zakaria uses the term illiberal democracy, and I think that's exactly the right term, because without safeguards, without the safeguards that we call the liberal institutions, and that has nothing to do with American liberalism or conservatism, but institutions that allow liberty, democracy is a pretty rotten form of government, because what it becomes then is the ability for 51% of the people to do whatever they want to the other 49% of the people, as long as they vote for it. So Tocqueville has a wonderful expression. He says, ultimately, if I'm being trampled on, it doesn't matter whether there's 1 foot or a million feet on my chest. You know, it doesn't matter if tyranny comes in the form of a king or in the form of a majority vote. It's still tyranny if you're not in the majority. So the idea, democracy itself is a dubious achievement. Liberal democracy is the great achievement of the 20th century. And that is a system where you vote and elect your officials, but at the same time, there are robust protections for speech, for minority rights, for the press, for different religious viewpoints, including no religious viewpoint at all. All of these things are protected by institutions that are erected to make sure that the majority can't override the liberty of the minority. But the problem is that there are enough mechanisms in a democracy that over enough time you can tear down those institutions. a healthy, independent federal judiciary is one of the most important institutions that we have for ensuring liberalism, for ensuring that that these liberties that the majority can't simply walk all over the minority. But if somebody is in office long enough and appoints all the judges and nobody blocks the appointment of the judges, then the judiciary can become part of the illiberal mechanism or the illiberal institutions instead. So that's why Tocqueville said it all comes down to the mores, the unspoken habits, what people believe, because people have to believe in democracy for it to work. You can't put in barriers and guardrails that will hold forever if people stop believing in the concept that other people have rights to, that people in the minority have the right to be represented, and have the right to have their liberties safeguarded. And no form of government can prevent the trampling of people's liberties if the people don't have the unspoken habits of protecting the system as a liberal democracy. That was Tocqueville's main point.
One thing that happened to me when I was young was we had a big political club in Oklahoma and the university, and we built in all these protections, all these. We spent months having a constitution for our little club. We built in all these protections, and then one day the majority decided to do something, and they didn't tell a lot of the other people, and they came in and took the whole thing over, took all the money and everything else. So all our institutional written things were overwhelmed by the feeling that there was this deep division that they had to override it. In other words, the mores kept things going, not just literally the written Constitution, because if people don't care about the Constitution, if they don't care about civil liberties, all the writing in the world is not going to do anything. People have to have faith in the Constitution and in our traditional ways of doing things. If they lose faith, if they go off in all these different directions, the country won't really, it already is not what it once was.
Yes, that's the institutions can slow down the march to tyranny, but they can't stop it. The only way to prevent that from happening is that people have to want freedom for people other than themselves, and I can't stress that enough. And that's what civic friendship comes down to. Civic friendship means that whether or not you agree with me, whether or not you're on my side, I think that the country should work for you, too. And when you're in power, you want the country to work for me, too. And if we lack that, if we give that up, then it will just be a matter of time before our institutions reflect our mores.
It's easy to see because we have other countries in Europe and Asia and stuff who are theoretical democracies, who are not really democracies, that the rule of law and just the mores. And I come from studying philosophy from the Confucius point of view, and Confucius called these li. These are the rituals of human life. And what supports the Constitution, I believe, and I had not read this, de Tocqueville, is the mores, which we call li, the rituals of human life. So the ritual is for the president who's outgoing to embrace the president who's coming in, to help him establish his presidency, to help him in any way he can, and to gracefully, concede, and to gracefully go, usually, to his inauguration, even though it's probably not the most fun time of his life. All these mores are holdings up, and what we've seen, particularly in the last 4 years, but before that, is a breakdown of the mores. And you can argue about some of them. For example, the Congress, controlled by Republicans, refused to even consider, discuss, interview a nomination by President Obama to the Supreme Court. That was a change in mores, because before, everyone was respectful of the president. If he nominated somebody, they went through a whole process and then they decided. Then what happened recently is, in an even shorter period of time, the Republicans and Mitch McConnell put in a Supreme Court justice in a shorter period of time than the one that they objected to. So what it means was that there's no reciprocity. In other words, there's not a rule of being fair to the other guys. It's just power. It's just, we have the power to do this. We have a power not to consider your Supreme Court justice, even though it's probably not happened in American history. And we have a problem to appoint ours, whether you like it or not, in a shorter time. So there's no reciprocity. There's no feeling of fairness. It's just power. And it exposes raw power. And that exposing of raw power really doesn't matter much whose side it is. That exposition of power makes right, I think, just undercuts our democracy terribly.
Yeah, there's a concept called institutional forbearance, which means that you don't use every bit of power available to you in order to accomplish a short-term objective, and that has held in the Senate more or less for most of the time that the Senate has been in existence. It hasn't always held in the House, but in the Senate there's sort of a sense that you know generally you allow the president to appoint cabinet members and you don't refuse to consider cabinet members. The same thing with the federal judiciary. You allow the president to make appointments even if the president isn't of your party. There's a real danger if the Senate becomes a place where only presidents of the same party can have appointments supported or can have their nominations confirmed. Then we face a situation where unless the president and the Senate are of the same party, the president can't govern. And that's a dangerous situation for the business of governing, which is not at all the same as the business of getting elected. And sometimes I fear that that's where we're headed, that the actions of the last few years have made it very difficult, will in the future make it very difficult for presidents to perform the minimal tasks of governing the country, unless the Senate is also of their party. And all Supreme Court nominations will probably now come in those rare times when the Senate and the presidency belong to the same party. And that's a precarious situation to be in, because the Supreme Court does other things than politics. And most of their decisions are important and don't really benefit one party or the other. But if we can't even get people nominated to the Supreme Court and confirmed, that's going to be a serious problem with the operations of the country. And, both sides, I think, operate under the illusion that at some point in the future, they're going to win such a huge victory that the other side is going to be irrelevant. And that's just not going to happen. Whatever we think about the other side, it's not going anywhere. And we've got to figure out how to govern a country that is made up of people who disagree with each other. And if we can't do that, either we're going to not be able to govern or we're not going to be able to have a democracy.
I think that's a stark way to put what seems to be happening. And it seems to be a product of the polarization. Although I go back to my friends when we would argue about guns and so forth and so on. And I'm not a big banning gun guy, but the selectivity of the incidents which were used to argue. And of course, logically, if you've taken rhetoric or been debate, using a single example of a little old lady who shoots a burglar or an angry guy who shoots his girlfriend's boyfriend, climbing through a window. Neither one of those is really exactly an argument. But the selectivity of the disagreement is much like the selectivity of these incidents. In other words, the disagreement as if there's a grain of wood and the disagreements get pulled up. So they seem to dominate everything, and the agreements seem to just fade into the background.
I think that's absolutely true. We don't argue with each other very much. We shout at each other. We criticize each other. We call each other names. Argument is something that has at its basis the desire to persuade somebody. Nobody has ever been persuaded by being called crazy, stupid, or evil. It's possible for a very short term to shame somebody into taking a position or doing something based on that sort of rhetoric, but actual persuasion requires some kind of goodwill between the persuader and the persuadee, and it requires some vulnerability. If I'm going to persuade you, I have to be vulnerable enough to listen to you, and you might persuade me. And that does happen. Persuasion is very, very possible. I think that's a myth that we have to bust. We can persuade other people, but we can't persuade them entirely to our point of view. If it's probably not going to happen that I take somebody who is a very hardcore MAGA Trump supporter, and I'm not going to turn them into a liberal socialist hippie through any amount of conversation. So absolute switching of sides is difficult. But if I talk to somebody with goodwill for a long period of time and listen to them, it's very likely that I'm going to have some change of my position, and so are they, as we start to see that the other position really isn't the caricature that it's portrayed as in our echo chambers. So talking to each other with some sense of goodwill, and this is where politeness is important. I do think politeness is a good thing, but human beings tend to be very argumentative when they argue, for obvious reasons. And so I actually think that forgiveness is more important than politeness. It's important that we forgive each other. Friends aren't always polite to each other. Family members aren't always polite to each other. But we forgive each other, and we try to work on the relationship. But for me to be able to persuade somebody of something, I first have to value them, convince them that I value them, convince them that the relationship is important, then they're going to give me a chance to persuade them.
Well, we're pretty much out of time. Michael Austin, the author of a new book, author of many books. You go on Amazon and they have a lot of his books, both political and his literary criticism. Thank you for being with us. Next week we have a show with Gary LeMaster, our researcher, Hava Derby, and we'll be discussing QAnon and the effect of QAnon in the spiritual community. How QAnon, which is basically a right-wing conspiracy in origin, ended up being popular among the wellness community, I guess you could call it. There's a lot of different terms. So that'll be the show next week. I hope folks will turn in. I hope you guys will visit Amazon and look for Michael Austin's books. He has a series of really interesting books. Michael, thank you very much for being with us.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZN. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.